tonight we have 5 readers. We'll have 3, and then we can take a break or not, whatever you want to do. It's fine. And it shouldn't take too long.
Well, wait, time, I've got something, too. I didn't know how I was supposed to sign up for that.
Oh, to read?
To read.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That'd be great. Yeah. Then we have 6 readers. Okay.
So I bring it along. If, you know.
So this is our 4th reading. This is our 3rd this year. This is our 1st horror-specific reading. Normally it's straight up science fiction and fantasy, so we have some more creepy stories tonight, which should be fun, which is why we have all these fun fake candles. I asked Rachel if I could have real candles, and she said no, massive fire hazard. So our 1st reader tonight is Beth Stombach, who, as a child, Beth slept with a cross on her bedside to keep the vampires away. Now that she is a mature, sensible adult, she sleeps with a collection of daggers on her bedside table instead. She has experience being haunted by a ghostly cat. Hopefully you didn't use the daggers. When not trying to keep supernatural entities at bay, she instead focuses on keeping her overactive imagination under control by writing strange stuff like this. And her story is called Till Death Do Us Part.
Thank you, Louise. When Leo woke up, the first thing he saw was the dark figure with a scythe standing over his bed. He wasn't sure he was really seeing it. The room was full of flames, and smoke hung so thickly in the air that it was difficult for him to be sure that he was seeing anything at all. Leo coughed painfully. He must have been breathing smoke for some time. He rubbed his eyes. The figure did not go away. Summer, wake up. Do you see? He started to reach for her, but the bed was empty. Summer, where'd you go? I have already taken her, said the hooded figure. At least something said it. The voice seemed to come from under the ground. Leo stared for a moment. The figure stood motionless, the firelight playing over his blade. It was a plain sort of scythe, its wood shiny with use, and its edges scuffed. It looked very old. If this is some kind of prank, Leo began, and started coughing once more. Never mind, I'm out of here. Yes, you are, the figure agreed, and brought down his scythe. Leo felt the blade pass through him. He wanted to scream, but suddenly he had no breath, and his body was being peeled away from him like the rind of an orange. Then he was falling, and everything went dark. His last thought was one of satisfaction. The Reaper had told him that Summer had already been taken. She would already be there waiting for him on the other side. He would have smiled if he could have. She had been wrong. They really were going to be together forever. He had met her in an art gallery. He had been there because it was holding an exhibition of the work of some great artist from days gone by, and he had gone to see it. Not because he wanted to, but because it felt like the sort of thing an aspiring artist ought to do, and perhaps he would find some inspiration. Instead, he'd found Summer, standing in one of the galleries, looking at Renaissance paintings of Greek and Roman deities, messing around with other Greek and Roman deities. She could have been the model for one of them, beautiful in a stately way, with red blonde hair falling in attractively disordered waves, and skin the color of cream and honey. Leo had found her to his taste and drifted closer to her, pretending to be looking at the paintings until he was standing beside her. "Oh, hi," he said, as though he'd just noticed her. "I didn't see you there." "That's quite all right," she said, smiling at him. She was older than he had first guessed, but still more than attractive. Up close, he could smell her perfume, like flowers. "Are you alone?" he asked. "For the time being." She gestured with her left hand, showing off a particularly large and glittering diamond. "He's gone away on business and left me to entertain myself." "Is there anything I could do to help entertain you?" he asked. "Maybe," she said, giving him an inviting smile. "Perhaps we could discuss it over coffee." "Gladly," he replied. He offered her his arm. "I'm Leo. What's your name?" She made a pretty pout. "I don't like my name. It's so old-fashioned." "I'll call you whatever you want," he said. "Then call me Summer," she said, "to remind you that I'm not going to be here forever. Once the summer is over, I'm going to go back to my husband." Then she smiled again. "Until then, though." And that had been it for him. At first, it had been no more than the basic desire to get closer to an attractive woman, and perhaps a little bit of a taste for adventure. Taking up with an older married woman seemed like the kind of lark he would be able to write in his autobiography someday when he was rich and famous. She had made it clear that the relationship was not going to last, but with every passing day he found himself wishing more and more that he could keep her around. Not only was she beautiful, but she seemed to have an interest in practically everything, and could speak knowledgeably on a variety of topics that left him in awe of her. He had daydreamed about asking her to leave her husband and stay with him, but he knew it was a lost cause. Not that she gave any indication of being in love with him. She had never even mentioned his name. But he was clearly a wealthy man, and he was a struggling artist working part-time in a mall kiosk, and would never be able to treat her in the manner she was obviously used to. Leo was forced to resign himself to being her temporary toy, but he couldn't help dreaming that someday his art would become famous enough to make him a valid contender for her permanent affection. But now that was never going to happen, because he was dead. It would have been enough to make him laugh if he could. His parents had told him he was going to die a nobody when he'd said he was majoring in art, and they'd been right. But now he was dead, and Summer was dead, and her interfering husband was still in the world of the living, probably not even knowing she was gone yet. She was there beside him. Leo suddenly realized that he was in a cavern, a world of gray and black stone with no clear light source, and he seemed to be drifting slowly through it like a jellyfish in a gentle current. Summer was beside him, keeping pace with him, but she looked different. She seemed older now, and she wore a loose gray dress instead of her usual up-to-the-minute fashions. Her hair had turned silvery, and her skin was pale as fog. Only her eyes and lips held any color at all. He tried to speak to her, but no sound would come. She gave him a small smile. "Poor thing," she said. "I'll walk with you a little way. It's the least I can do." They drifted in silence. Leo wished he could talk to her, but his voice stayed locked somewhere inside of him. At last, the two of them emerged into a vast chamber of polished black and white stone. Leo gawped at it, and for a fleeting instant he wished for his paint box. He had never been much for representational art, but this was something he would have loved to try to paint. The room itself seemed to have been carved directly out of a solid lump of obsidian, black and shiny and sharp. The details, though, seemed to be made of something white and curving, something that reminded him of bone, though it didn't resemble the bones of any creature he'd ever seen. They were too big and curved into bizarre whorls and twists. They climbed in rungs up the wall and swooped overhead in arches like the branches of bare trees. A path down the center of the room was marked with a row of them that had been fashioned into lampposts. Sticky-looking blobs of some waxy substance put out a faint blue luminescence, dangling from each one. At the far end of the room were two chairs made of the same bony white material. A man sat in one. He wore a black cloak, with the hood pushed back to reveal a handsome but grim face, and a scythe rested across his lap. The other chair was empty. Summer went to sit in it. "Persephone," the man said. "Welcome home." "Persephone?" Leo's voice suddenly returned him. "No, wait. This isn't right. This is crazy." "I'm sorry," she said. She sounded like a little girl apologizing for hitting her brother. Not sorry at all, but knowing it was expected that she say it. The man on the throne gave Leo a stern look. "Do you have anything to say in your defense?" "Why are you blaming me?" Leo demanded. "It's half her fault, too. She went along with it." "You knew she was married," the man said. "You knew she was not yours to take, yet you never hesitated to pursue her. She is a goddess of life and fertility. Her nature is eternal and unchanging. I cannot blame her for acting according to her nature, even when her nature goes against my wishes. You, though, are human. You always have a choice in your actions. Therefore, it is my right to punish you, or to take revenge." Leo had a sudden flash of all the mythology he'd ever read. Stories about Sisyphus eternally rolling his stone up the hill, or Tantalus standing neck-deep in water and unable to drink. "What are you going to do to me?" he whispered. Death gave him the smallest of smiles, and there was no kindness in it. "Nothing," he said. "You are forever banished from my realms. You will never return to this place again. Now, go." Leo cast a desperate glance at Summer, at Persephone. He realized that he had never known anything about her, and had never really tried to find out. He'd been happy as long as she'd been willing to hang on his arm and sleep in his bed. If he had tried to know more, would he have realized where this was leading? Her expression was sulky, like a child being told to put her toys away and get ready for school. Then the world tipped over backwards, and he felt himself falling through darkness again. When he landed, he was standing outside his building. The fire was still smoldering, but the firemen seemed to have gotten the blaze under control. They were spraying the area thoroughly with their hoses, sometimes passing the stream straight through him. Other people were running around helping the other tenants escape, or carrying living or dead bodies out on stretchers. Leo saw his and looked away. Instead, he looked at the sky. The sun was starting to come up, but it was hidden behind heavy gray clouds. It was, he thought, going to be a cold autumn, and summer wasn't going to come back. The end.
Next review is John Tanzi. John Tanzi is a local real estate broker specializing in selling burial plots in the Maplewood Cemetery. Yes, you too can spend eternity with Charlottesville's most notable characters and personalities. See John after tonight's readings to put down your deposit.
Thank you. The story is titled House of Writer House or Salon of the Dead. Hey Mona, look at this, where the dirt's falling away. There's a brick wall. The slab-faced city worker, nicknamed for his penchant for complaining, stood with arms crossed, looking down into the utility trench they were digging. So what? It's a foundation, Mona said. No, it's not. Look. These are old bricks. With a huff, Mona unfolded his arms and lowered himself into the trench. Hey, you're right. These are old bricks. You can scrape the mortar out with your fingernail. Mona pulled out a pocket knife and started digging at the mortar around several bricks. Soon he wiggled one free. Get me a flashlight from the truck, he ordered. In a moment, one was tossed to him. It's hollow back there, like a cave. Looks like it goes back under that building. Phew, what a stink. Hey, Moose, call back to the yard and ask if there's a basement under 508 Dale Avenue. There shouldn't be. 2 hours later, the drone of a powerful ventilator fan could be heard from blocks away, and the buildings around 508 Dale Avenue had been evacuated. The large, flexible duct guiding the flow from the fan into the underground chambers writhed like an animal alive. Workers in the trench and in the underground passages wore hazmat suits. Spark precautions were taken because the venting, noxious atmosphere might be explosive. Two hazmated suited responders with powerful LED lights slowly explored the warren of passages beneath 508 Dale Avenue. Look at this, one said. Looks like some sort of kitchen area. With a probe, he touched an open tin of sardines. Look at this tin. These might have been canned back in the 1950s. Indeed, the labeling appeared antique. The responder pushed the tin with his probe, and a cockroach ran out from beneath it and disappeared down the side of the crude shelf. An old percolator coffee pot sat on a gas burner connected by a rubber hose to an old gas line. Stacked wooden crates housed an assortment of old cans, sacks, and boxes, all faded and dingy. Look over here, the second responder said. He shone his light into a different chamber. Looks like some sort of sleeping quarters. There was a pallet on the earthen floor, a dark bundle that may have served as a pillow, and a filthy rug-like thing that may have been a blanket. You know, the first responder said, even in this suit I can feel the stink. Come on, this passage continues. Slowly they made their way down the brick-lined passage. It opened into a chamber where their lamplight whirled a kaleidoscope of horror. Three bodies sat on wooden boxes around a makeshift table. One was skeletal, The second was shriveled, mummy-like except for slimy skin. The third corpse was not long dead, just beginning to drip fluids onto the earth floor beneath its seat. Also beneath its seat was an object. One of the responders knelt and poked it with a probe. "It's a wallet." "Can you see identification?" the other said. "Yes," he said, pivoting slightly to shine his light onto the plastic card holder. "It belongs to a Clifford Garstang." "Look at this," the other said. He aimed his light onto the tabletop. In front of the vacant seat was a piece of paper bag. Written on it in fine script, "Welcome to the Artist Salon." Looks like someone was expecting a new guest. A brick in the chamber wall pulled away. A pair of yellow eyes stared out onto the scene. Several days later at Writer House, three members gathered to talk. "Oh my God," Chelsea said. "I can't believe that." "It's true," Rachel said. "The body had identification and the family confirmed it." "And he was in a room beneath Writer House?" "Yes, there's a maze of passages beneath us. One of those rooms was set up like a salon with a table and chairs and bodies sitting around it. A vacant place with an invitation." "Has Cliff been missing long?" "Not long," Rachel replied sadly. "He missed a couple classes he was teaching. We couldn't get in touch with him. It was odd. Cliff just wouldn't stand up students." Jennifer, who had been listening to the other two, said, "Whatever happened must have happened right here. Someone came in while the door was unlocked." There came a sudden clatter from the kitchen. The three women jumped with alarm. They were the only ones in the building. Then Chelsea laughed. "I put too many dishes in the drainer. Something settled." They all laughed. "I'm going home," Chelsea said. "Don't you two stay here long." She left the classroom where they had been talking. Rachel and Jennifer got busy organizing Writer House materials. They could hear Chelsea puttering around by the front desk. Suddenly came a shriek. Rachel and Jennifer jumped with alarm and rushed into the main hall. There, with huge skeletal-like hands around Chelsea's throat, was a dark figure, tall, wearing some kind of knee-length covering. Rachel and Jennifer both screamed. It swung around, one huge hand still on Chelsea's throat. Its face was long and dark with filth. Yellow eyes, yellow teeth, and long stringy hair draped over narrow, sharp shoulders. With a flick of its wrist, it smashed Chelsea's head into a door jamb. Then it turned on Rachel and Jennifer. They retreated into the classroom. Rachel fished around in her handbag. In a heartbeat, Jennifer saw there would be no call to 911. They were both dead. The creature swept in, just steps away from Rachel, when she dropped her handbag, and in her hand, instead of a cell phone, was a .327 Magnum. Bang! She fired off all six rounds. The blast froze both women in place. The creature stopped, a pained look about its livid, dark lips. It spun and ran towards the kitchen, emitting a yowl that rattled the windows. "Oh, my God," Jennifer whispered. Rachel knelt, fished in a handbag, retrieved a speed loader, and quickly reloaded the revolver. She crept on hands and knees into the front hall, surveying the scene. "I don't see it," she said. Jennifer hopped over her and rushed to Chelsea. "Oh, my God, I think she's hurt. I'm calling 911. Minutes later, police and emergency responders were all over Writer House and beneath it. Rachel and Jennifer sat in a classroom, facing a detective. "Are you going to arrest me?" Rachel said. "No, we'll have you come down to headquarters and make a statement and take more details, but we're not going to arrest you. You have a permit." The detective motioned to an officer who was drawing small circles on the floor around Rachel's spent shell casings. "You weren't firing blanks?" "No, self-defense rounds," Rachel said. "We're not finding holes in any of the walls. You must have put every bullet into your target." "It was close, like from me to you." "That was brave," the detective said. "How's Chelsea?" "She was unconscious when they carried her out of here." "Have you found that thing?" Jennifer asked. "We found a blood trail in one of the passages below this building. It leads to a way outside, but we lose it in the stream next to the railroad tracks. We need to get the dogs in to help." How this person of interest ever fit through that tiny hatchway beneath the kitchen sink is beyond me. But until we do find him, or her, or whatever, I suggest you lock the doors here. It seems to have some affinity for your members of your organization. Across Dale Avenue from Ryder House, in the chamber deep beneath the York Building, sat a figure in deep despair, rocking back and forth on a dank and filthy pallet. In total darkness, in rejection, it cried. It cried for the loss of its artist salon. It cried with the healing of its many wounds. And it tasted amidst the bile leaking from its bowels the vengeance it bore for Ryder House. The end. Thank you. It was a dark and stormy night. Josh Pritchett is our next reader. Josh Pritchett finally met his lifelong hero, Stan Lee, last month. Josh's writing is influenced by Stan Lee, Stephen King, Ray Bradbury, and Edgar Allan Poe. His art style is inspired by the works of Jack Kirby and Brian Hitch. In addition to writing and art, Josh is an accomplished weightlifter, an activist who also speaks Klingon.
From the deep. The door had opened for the first time in a very long time. It had been patient. It had waited. They had sealed it in, trapped it back inside its own world, while it waited and remembered and planned a million torments and retributions against the puny little things that had once worshipped it, praised its name, raised cities and temples in its honor, and sacrificed. Yes, the sweet sacrifices that fed it daily. Darkness and cold greeted it when it crossed over. Deep, great and deep waters had covered its last great temple. No matter, pushing itself upward on miles of tentacles, it broke the surface and tore apart something made of metal. Was it an altar? Something they had erected so close to its temple? It did not think so. Has the metal platform exploded? It watched as the men who were on the platform screamed and burned to death. It savored this impromptu sacrifice before moving on. Great mountains had pushed up and become the land that they lived on now. It could feel them, almost hear them. A buzzing metal object flew by it. There were humans inside it. They had wrought great things with their metal. It would have to be destroyed. All of it would have to be destroyed to bring them back to a simpler plane of existence where they worshipped it again. It made its way up through marshes and swamps that were new when it was here there last. As it moved northwards, it found the dead, lying in stone crypts. With barely a thought, it ripped open the crypts, and from its tentacles, it released the worms. They were tiny things that leaked back to... They were tiny things that linked back to its mind. Slowly, the worms found their way into the decaying bodies and the tombs and reached the rotted cortexes, where they started the dead up again, as if they were nothing more than broken-down machines. The dead rose and started to walk before it, these foot soldiers in a new army that would bring the world to heal. It was the same in a dozen graveyards. It opened the tombs again and again and reactivated hundreds of the dead until it found the living. They brought their machines, puny toys that could do little to hurt it. Its army overwhelmed them, sharing with them the gift of obedience and curing them of the cancer of free will. Presently, they found a city, a great one to be sure, and it commanded its army to fan out and share the gift with those who lived there. In the distance, it could hear them all scream. And that was good. Some part of them remembered it, remembered the awe and majesty it inspired, and the terror and the blood and the sacrifice. It felt the faithful's numbers grow in every minute. It was in every mind, reshaping and preparing it for the work to come. Then they came. Just as before, they came. The beings that looked like humans, but were so much more. The ones who could run faster than wind, fly like birds, lift mountains with their hands, and bring the painful light. But this time, it was ready. It commanded the faithful to press on and take them and give them the gift. Some did, and it controlled some of them now. It had their gifts, and it had its gift. The others fell back. They did not want to hurt their... They did not want to hurt their fellows or the normals. They had no stomach for it. It did not care. All it cared about was obedience and sacrifice. And then he came. It watched as he flew down from the sky and rescued the normals and the untouched and the special ones, almost tearing them from its grasp. No! It screamed in silence. Then he stood above the faithful as they tried to reach for him to share the gift. And he brought the lightning down on them, brought it down and made it bloom out like a wildfire. It screamed as the faithful died, burned away like dead leaves. The ground shook. He called its name, the name only a few knew from the old days, and it knew this one was wise and powerful beyond understanding. He flew at it, hitting it hard and sending it staggering. It rallied and lashed out with its tentacles. He grabbed one, and it screamed again as he tore the tentacle off. The tentacle grew back. But the blow was struck, and it knew it would have to destroy this one itself. They fought. It lashed out with tentacles and waves of pain from its mind. But he fought through it and flew faster than the tentacles. He lashed out with strong fists and lightning from the sky. It had spent too much time in the darkness. It was losing. No matter how hard it fought, he would fight back harder. And it felt what was driving him, the one thing it could not abide, hope. It knew then that he was also functioned on sacrifice. Only he sacrificed himself for them, and it needed their sacrifice. Then something happened. He got in close and took hold of its mass. He tried to unleash the worms on him, to take control of him, what a servant he would make. But he kept bringing the lightning down again and again and again, cleansing himself of the gift. It screamed in frustration again and again as he lifted it off of the earth. It tried to hold to it, cling to the ground, but he was too strong. He could draw more and more power from elsewhere. It knew not where. As he lifted it higher and higher. Gravity tried to pull them both back, but he was too strong for that. It kept fighting, but it was hard to reach him and take a hold of him. It sent more pain, tried to find fear in him. Nothing worked. It knew it was hurting him, but he didn't seem to care or just fought through the pain again and again. They were in the void then, where its bulk was no longer an asset. It flailed and lashed about to no avail, and then it saw where they were heading, and it screamed again in horror. He pushed it into the sun. The heat burned and popped its flesh, and it screamed and begged for mercy. How could this happen? It shouted in silence. I am one of the three whose name is not spoken. I am all. I am great. You are nothing. You are meant to serve and die. In the end, it begged to go back to its own dimension, to the cold darkness. In response, he turned and flew away. The end.
Alright. You ready to hear some more scary stories? I should have mentioned in the first place. So we are a genre group here at Writer House who hosts us for our meetings once a month, if anyone would like to join. I know 50% of you are already in the group, so... we meet the second Tuesday of the month, currently, 7 o'clock, in the salon. Not the under salon, not the creepy salon, the one ground floor. And we do other stuff together, we see movies together, we hang out, we have lots of fun. So it's been going for 3 years now, I think, so pretty good, a number of people coming along. And one of our members is our next reader, Bonnie Redding, who feels she has wallowed in reality far too deeply in recent months. Besides doing her day job, she is riding a new horse, teaching kids to do stunts on a moving horse, and helping to get out the vote for President Obama. Good choice. I can't vote, so good choice. These activities have sucked away her time. Bonnie's fantasy world, which has produced 2 book-length manuscripts, calls to her, and if she could just kick the reality habit, Bonnie's horsey fantasy kids' adventure stories would gallop forward. Over to Bonnie.
Or do something to become citizens?
I'm a green card holder. We can do everything except vote.
Okay.
It's a bit drafted.
Hadn't heard that one.
Let me try. Okay. This is Halloweenish, but it's not horror. So I have to put, and my apologies to people who know nothing about Lord of the Rings. Sorry. Okay. It's called The Costume Party. It wasn't easy squeezing through a crowd with the front and back end of a stuffed horse tied around her waist. "Excuse me," Gwen said, as the horse head connected with something solid. She shifted her helmet with one hand to increase her field of vision and apologized again to a person dressed as a tree. No, an ant. It ignored the armored woman and flailed its branches while speaking to someone in a frighteningly real troll outfit. "Oof." Gandalf, or someone in a white beard sporting a wizard hat, exhaled as he bumped into the horse's rump sticking out behind her. There were more apologies. Gwyn edged her way to the hors d'oeuvres, greeting folks she knew on the way. The horse's armor hung low enough so that her legs were completely covered. This did not stop 2 children dressed as dwarves from careening off them before sliding under the table. A look of horror crossed her face. Dwarves gave her the creeps. Underground-dwelling, jewel-worshipping shrimps were not very appealing. And Gimli's bravado, come on. The kids emerged with arms full of large cardboard gems. It must be a treasure hunt. They dropped them and took off after a little girl dressed as an elf. "Tree hugger," one yelled. "War," the other shrieked. Parents scrambled to collar their offspring. The woman in armor grimaced. When she looked up, Gwyn saw him at the punch bowl, a black rider. He sipped from a large cup through a straw. Why had he dressed like this, the black rider in the room wondered. The heavy concealing cowl hung down over his face, and he couldn't even toss back a drink without revealing who he was, which would not be cool. Orin wasn't necessarily welcome here, but the free food and drink had drawn him. Besides, he knew a few of the folks. A skinny guy in a loincloth and a golem mask fell into the black horse butt that stuck out behind Orin. He pulled a string, and a stuffed horse leg kicked the golem guy. The fellow's mask fell off and he cringed. Orin snorted. His costume required that edge. He glanced across the table. There was someone in armor wearing a white horse around her waist, with legs painted on the skirt just like his black horse. He would have laughed, but this rider wore rosy lipstick on the flawless mouth beneath her helm. Gleaming blonde hair spread out across her back. She smiled. "I'm Eowyn," she said. Gwyn reached for a punch cup as the face of her horse dipped into some canapes. "Oops," she whispered, wiping off the muzzle. "I'm Black Rider number 3, Orin said in a deep and spooky voice. "So what's your real name?" he asked. "No, no, no," she giggled. "I can't tell." They joked about their horse costumes, and Gwyn told him she had a live horse, somewhat better put together than this one. He told her that he used horse-powered machinery for a very small mine operation at home. Her mare was more of a trail horse, but they talked for an hour about everything from what saddles they preferred to which dewormers were most effective. Music drew them to the dance floor, and the 2 trotted around each other, black and white horses dipping and bobbing to the fast music. When the music slowed, they sidled up next to each other, turned sideways to their horse costumes, and put their arms around each other. Gwyn raised her visor, and Orin pushed back his cowl slightly, and they gazed into each other's eyes. "What magical turquoise eyes," Orin said. Gwyn could barely make out his shadowed face, but his square jaw and light-catching eyes held her attention. They danced and flirted, ignoring the calls to join in the Lord of the Rings Trivial Pursuit game. When Orin had to leave to go to his night shift job, they set up a date for the next day. In the dark of the driveway, they kissed. She returned briefly to the party. Pin the tail on the Balrog was fun for about 5 smoking minutes. A trio of orcs was enjoying it, but they kept trying to pin the tail on the back end of her horse. Too much punch. It was time to go. Sue, the hostess, in a stunning goldberry costume, told her to be careful about black riders and winked. The next afternoon, Gwen dressed as herself and entered a coffee shop in the nearby town of Fairhaven. She ordered berry tea and settled at a table near the fireplace, avoiding the gnomes near the door. Some other elves were sipping tea, but she didn't know them. Orin walked in. Three elves scooted behind a sofa. Gwen and Orin stared at each other. He was actually a dwarf, much shorter than he had appeared in the Black Rider outfit. She stood up, tall and slender. Orin's eyes twitched at the sight of Gwen's pointy elf ears and dark hair. They both balked. Then they walked slowly forward, eyeing each other suspiciously. "You were a lot taller last night," she said. "A bit of special magic for the party," he chuckled until he caught her eye. His manner turned grim. "You put a spell on me, sure enough." "I did no such thing. At a party hosted by humans, it would be too risky." "At least one elf and one dwarf had a truce for one night," the squat man said wistfully. "Truly," the elf girl sighed. "That's where it ends." They shook hands and walked out of the shop toward their horses, tied to the porch railing. "I brought my," they both began. The stout dwarf smiled as Gwyn's dapple-grain mare gave him a little nudge with her muzzle. Gwen fished a sugar cube from her jacket and offered it to Orin's gelding. The pony was only a little smaller than her mare. "He has such a strong neck," Gwen couldn't resist talking about horses. "Is he part draft horse?" "His mother was a halflinger," Orin grinned at his beloved pony. "I call him Clay." "My mare is Lark," Gwen said. "She has some dainty hooves, that one," Orin replied. They continued to point out their horses' good points and mounted up. "Truce?" they both asked at once. Together they rode out of the clearing where Fairhaven's buildings clustered together, and they cantered across a meadow garnished with a zest of wildflowers. Aww. Not scary. I need to introduce Louise. Louise discovered sci-fi and fantasy when she was a child and started writing Star Trek fan fiction when she was in high school. Many years later, she's still writing in both genres as well as trying her hand at horror and speculative fiction on occasion while maintaining a day job in microbiology. She wishes she could spend as much time with science fiction as she does with science fact. Our leader.
Story on the pad. That's not my story. That's not my story. Where is it? There's my story. My story is called Hijack. You can see it. Ellie had instructed her Atmos glass windows to wake her gently. She was a creature of habit, who knew herself and her weaknesses well. Last night, she'd intended to get thoroughly intoxicated, so in preparation, she had drunk her usual glass of heavy antiol, a successful invention carefully treated and marketed to the overindulgers of all chemical vices to help soak up toxic effects and minimize the crash. Not usually one for excess, the loss of her employment had quashed her inhibitions, and she had drunk far more than the guaranteed strength of the preventative. The headache that thumped behind her eyes was bad, but not unbearable. The mid-morning light shone in a muted grey thanks to the effective Atmos glass. Ellie rubbed her dry eyes, and it took her a few seconds before she realised she was not alone. She looked to her right to the naked female who slept beside her in the bed. The woman was beautiful, flawless, and her dark brown hair draped sensually over her milky flesh. Confused and a little unnerved, Ellie looked back to the ceiling of her small bedroom, and without a spoken word, she opened her neural memoir program. While the alcohol had left her with fuzzy recollections and gaping holes of the night before, the program would have dutifully recorded everything she saw and heard into her parabrain. It was a common program, originally designed for journalists, but quickly caught on with anti-crime proponents. Ellie found the file of her most recent archive and streamed it to her left eye, leaving the right one clear should her companion awaken. She closed her right eye and started the video of the archive. Watching these always made her feel queasy, not the best sensation given her hangover.
The replay bounced up and down in time to her accelerated walking speed, and the nightclub she had gone to with her friends zoomed closer. She was watching in 10 speed. Any faster really would make her sick, and anything slower would take too long. The camera filter had adapted to the darkness inside the nightclub, but she overlaid another filter as she watched to improve the detail. It was hard for her not to cringe as the measure of her overindulgence rocketed past shot after shot in high definition 10 speed. Then she saw her. Pause, she mentally instructed her parabrain, and the image froze. Ellie switched eyes and stole a glance at the sleeping woman. Gently, she brushed back the silky brown hair from her face. The woman murmured at her touch, and Ellie couldn't help but marvel at her beauty. She had never dated anyone so attractive. It seemed incredible that she could have convinced someone home with her while so wasted. She resisted an urge to caress the soft cheek and instead returned to her memoir program. It was definitely the same woman. It took half an hour to relive the rest of the time in the club. The dancers contorting in their zero-gravity cages were difficult to focus on and featured so much in the replay that Ellie needed to pause and switch eyes several times to calm the rising nausea. The woman had seemed interested in her and they had talked at great length. She would need to listen in real time to discern the topics, but judging from facial expressions, it had been something Ellie had said that initially attracted the woman. They had danced intimately. The replay went completely black periodically. Ellie always closed her eyes when she kissed. Her friend's pleased expressions surrounded her briefly before she left the nightclub with the woman. Oh no, I closed it. Sophia, help me. Oh, I found it. I'm so sorry, I just closed it. Okay. The replay jerked between the wobbly road, her feet, and the beautiful woman's face. Ellie frowned. Each time her recollection film self looked at the woman, she smiled, but her smile had a coldness to it. She found the predatory look to it a little worrisome. Clearly her intoxicated self had been oblivious. The replay went dark again as she had leaned in to kiss her companion. Ellie shut off the replay. Even though there was no way she could feel them, the electrodes that wired her parabrain into her cerebellum seemed to be throbbing in harmony with her headache. Carefully, she rose to her feet and padded softly to the ensuite bathroom. She returned with a glass of water. She felt better after drinking it and returned to the bed. The woman appeared to still be asleep, and Ellie brought up her virtual archive again. She froze the image on the woman's face outside the nightclub and stared, eye out of focus and glazed, upon that beautiful and disturbing smile. When her hand touched her leg, she startled, physically jerking in the bed. Her reaction startled her companion as well. Ellie quickly shut off her archive while turning her head back to the woman, both eyes open. The woman smiled at her. The smile was disarming, and Ellie found herself completely helpless in it. She smiled back. For a moment, uncertainty and vague annoyance flashed across the woman's face. It was gone so quickly, Ellie found herself unsure if she had simply imagined it. "Good morning, Ellie," the woman purred and shifted closer, leaning in for a kiss. "Good morning." Ellie stalled. She had no idea the woman's name. Laughter brushed across her shy lips from her companion. "Cassandra," she breathed. "You are forgiven. How do you feel after last night?" Before Ellie could answer, Cassandra leaned in and kissed her slowly. Automatically, Ellie closed her eyes and relaxed in the embrace. Cassandra wound her fingers through Ellie's auburn hair, pulling gently and inviting a more passionate response. Digging and twirling through her hair, Ellie was truly disarmed when Cassandra's fingers found their true mark. At the base of Ellie's skull, hidden beneath her wavy hair, was a small copper disc, the external port into her parabrain. Cassandra twisted her index finger deftly and connected her metallic fingernail to the disc. The result was immediate. Ellie's body locked entirely, eyes closed and mouth parted, her passionate kiss now a silent scream. The file transfer lasted a few seconds, and the virus integrated itself smoothly, hijacking her parabrain. It reversed the hierarchy, and the parabrain took control of the biological brain. Ellie breathed again once the handover was complete. It was a remarkably efficient power transfer. She had barely missed a breath or two, and physically felt none the worse for it. Her eyes opened. Cassandra was standing above her now, dressing. She smiled, beautiful and cold, but Ellie could not smile back. "Smile," Cassandra said. "You're in love with me." Automatically, Ellie smiled as the VioWare contracted her facial muscles. Inside, her personality was intact. The Vioware needed it in order to create a convincing masquerade. She had heard of such violating software, but never once imagined she would be a victim of it. Cassandra was still smiling, but the Vioware had relaxed Ellie's face. Its link to her brain and her personality tracks had always deduced she was a brief smiler, a quick flash of sunshine, which no longer bore any warmth to it. We're now in a relationship, Ellie. You will get your job back tomorrow, and there will have been a mistake. You will do an exemplary job, and you will archive all the government files as you access them through daily routine. I will upload them from you. Cassandra brandished her metallic nail as she spoke. Ellie stared at her, her face impassive and her body still, while her mind raged with questions, panic, and alternating despair and futile hope. As though Cassandra could read the questions in her imprisoned mind, she smiled again, indulgently, and moved to sit on the edge of the bed. "I'm sorry, honey," she said softly. "It's nothing personal. There's always a sacrifice to be made for the greater good. You'll go down in a history. You'll go down in history as a hero of the revolution. You and me both." The fanaticism lit in her eyes as she spoke and leaned down on Ellie. "I had hoped the transfer worked last night, but I guess the alcohol provides a block to the virus. I honestly did not want you to have to witness this firsthand." She scowled suddenly, as though Ellie had directly accused her. "I'm not a sadist." In the blink of an eye, her scowl dissipated and replaced itself with another beautiful smile. "Now kiss me. There is much to be done." Ellie's body strained upwards and pressed her lips to Cassandra's. "I love you," murmured the hijacker. "I love you," replied her pawn. The end. So we have one last stealth reader showed up tonight, story in hand. So I'd like to welcome Keith to come and read his story. He is a ninja member of our group, hopefully going to come to some meetings, and his work is influenced by Douglas Adams.
Well, this is not really a scary one either, since my inspiration comes from Douglas Adams, who didn't write very many scary things, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, primarily. I wasn't sure what you expected for this, so I took from a story that I was writing, and I just lifted something out that would sort of stand alone. Let me tell you the few characters. This actually came, a lot of my inspiration also comes from my dream life, and I have never run into anybody who has as creative a dream life as I do, and I can talk to you about it sometime. It's fairly elaborate. It's been a part of my imagination since I was 8 years old. And I can call on dream creatures to talk to me anytime I want to, in my sleep, not now. So anyway, this was inspired by my dream creatures. It's first person. My wife, Carol, and I are the characters in there. You know what I look like. The other one is Drew. Now, Drew is the only syllable we can pronounce in his name. He's an alien who came to Earth and sought us out because some algorithm that his computer had said that we would help him. And so the problem was he cannot find his way back. The direction system in his ship has been damaged. And we have figured out that it costs far too much, I mean much more money than we have, to get this repaired. So he came up with the idea that he would use this advanced technology to create a business where we would make some money. And we thought this is great. We bought into it. He did a great sales job on it. Unfortunately, after we spent all our money and mortgaged ourselves up to the hilt, nobody came to buy. Hence the problem. Now, Drew also took on the persona, and he's in no way human. But when he flew in, he had to upload whatever he did. Coming over the Appalachians, he became an Appalachian boy of just out of puberty, who is typically very country-looking. "We're down on funds," Carol broke the silence. "The TV ads really hurt. We've got one more TV ad to shoot and air, then we're done. That's the contract, I'm sorry. It's my fault, I pushed for it. I thought we'd turn a profit at least by the 4th of July weekend." I was angry with Carol too, but that was unfair. I could have said something, but I saw the big bucks rolling in, now rolling out. So how can we turn this around? Carol sat upright. "We need something dramatic. Something no one can ignore. You're usually good at this, Keith." She looked straight at me. "One more TV ad, huh?" Fox News, Jody Winsome. We're here in Washington, on the Mall, on Independence Day. Probably the best day, the best place to be here. Hey, Thomas. Where are you, Thomas? Thomas Grayling. Yes, indeed. I'm right here at the reflecting pool, Jody, between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial. Picnickers showed up early with coolers and blankets. Some were here from last night. Spaces are filling fast. We all know this is the best place to watch the fireworks. Jody. I hear the music warming up. The rock group Crowd Control is here, and the country star Molly Dorham. Thomas. For sure. They're setting up right now between here and the Capitol. Fans are milling around. I'm excited. It's exciting and really crowded. This is a great place for people this is a great place to people watch, too. You get all types out here. I think they're calling for 500,000 on the Mall and another 1,000,000 in the surrounding area, along the GW Parkway and West Potomac Park. Meanwhile, back at the car wash, I leaned back onto the lawn chair and gestured toward the portable TV that we'd set up on an orange crate. Yes, yes. And those millions have cameras, and they're full with media coverage. Sweetheart, we may have paid for our last TV ad. Carol paced. Drew bounced expectantly. Out came Carol's ubiquitous checklist. The ad people should be here now. We need to set up before noon, and it's almost that time. Ah, here they are now. Fox News, Thomas Grayling. What was that? A sonic boom? That's the loudest, what? Those, the Air Force jets, F-22s, F-16s? No, wait. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, look. Cameras swung up above the Capitol building, and there a white light bloomed and billowed, bleaching the blue in a cloudless sky. The boom's pitch climbed to a high whine, then dropped low and began to pulse. Eyes shot up, guitars lowered, microphones dropped, beverage bottles swung down or bounced off the turf. Silence swept the odd crowd. It was right out of Day the Earth Stood Still or Earth versus the Flying Saucers. A brilliant disc dropped from the glow to descend on the Capitol. It glided deliberately at first, lower, then straight down the Mall, and the crowd-lined reflecting pool. Cameras large and small fixed on the disc, eyes glued to what everyone suspected, believed, or feared. My eyes teared up. Good, good, really good. So excellent. Carol, that sound clip was perfect. I shot my right hand up and shouted, Drew! He jumped high and slapped it. We laughed giddily, pointing to the camera precarious on the orange crate. Fox News, Thomas Grayling. Oh my God, what are we seeing? I can't believe it. The saucer. It's over the memorial and, oh, the Lincoln Memorial, crossing the Potomac. The Pentagon, it's crossing, heading toward the Pentagon. Fox News, Jody Winsome. Sally, do you see anything at the Pentagon? Fox News, Sally Campbell. Jody, yes, it's unbelievable. No one is moving, talking. What does this mean? What's happening now, Sally? The saucer, I don't know what else to call it. It stopped right over the Pentagon. Now it's moving south, down 395. It seems to be following the highway. I'm with the mobile unit, leaving the south parking lot right now. We'll try to keep up. It's left the highway, and it seems to be turning east, going down Van Dorn Street. I look around at the car wash. Our camera crew was glued on the TV set. Hey, guys, let's get going. Get your cameras up. Hey, miss? Carrie Klein. I read the announcer's name from her contract. It's coming this way. It'd be a good time to get ready, hey? From a distance, the mobile camera truck caught the saucer cruising by the landmark shopping mall and down and Duke Street. Still following Van Dorn, just before the light at Edsel Road, it slowed, dropped, and slid left, crossing the grassy median, and stopped to align with the center bay of our car wash. Drew stepped out casually, opening his palms toward them, down, turned down. The saucer obediently aligned, catching the tractor ramp. You fellows catching this? Right. I twisted, glancing behind on my lawn chair. The two cameramen stood, eyes glued to their cameras. They shook visibly, with fear or expectation. The saucer slid forward and out through the service bay in 88 seconds, glowing noticeably brighter thanks to Drew's instructions. The pulse sound, quieted during the washing, now grew deafening as the saucer rose 18 feet, rocking slightly in the summer breeze. Then it shot straight up out of sight. Our camera crew, aglow with sweat, fearing to miss the shot, followed its flight in silence. Then, to my surprise, "So you see," Carrie Klein croaked in her microphone, still in character, "another customer has come a long way to go to the great car wash, Ed's, Big Ed's car wash." Carrie smiled and winked at the camera. Her spontaneity would cost her $30,000 in legal bills. "I guess we kind of upstaged the fireworks," I chortled, hugging Carol and Drew, who was pogoing in place and laughing. Carol crossed her arms, chin raised and smiling broad enough to split her face. I felt brilliant then and for several days thereafter. We needed a cover story. I turned to our benighted announcer and camera crew and tried to look as astonished as they. Carrie was on her knees, her hands pressed to her face. "Oh my, oh my, oh yes." Then she quickly stood, checking her hair and makeup.